Hey, we're at the Southern Rocky Mountain Ag Conference. We're going to talk to Kathy James next. She's a PhD. She's with the Colorado School of Public Health. And what's really interesting about Kathy is she did a research. She's been studying groundwater quality in the San Luis Valley. And she has surveys from over 800 families across the valley. And you've been looking at water quality.
Correct.
You did the first study back in 2022, 2023 period,
yes.
Right?
Yep.
Take it from there. Update us, tell us about that and where we are.
Great. Well, thank you. And thank you to Chris and the Alamosa Citizen for having me here. It's I've been working in partnership with the San Luis Valley since 2006 with a strong focus on the well water quality and the overall ground health of the groundwater. And this latest study that we are just finishing up, I'm down here this week collecting our last round of samples, at least for this study. We're hoping to continue with future funding. But the focus of this was to really characterize where the metals are in the valley, because it's not a uniform distribution, and how the drought is impacting those metals. So we've been following multiple homes over 2.5 years. They've been contributing samples. So we first did a large community-wide sampling all the way from Creed all the way over to into the far east of Costilla County. We had over 850 households participate. And then from those households, we had about 40 continue and do quarterly samples for 2.5 years so that we could track some of these metals. We analyzed over 17 different metals with a strong focus on arsenic, uranium, manganese, tungsten, and lead, and also hardness as a key indicator, because those are the ones most associated with health.
What's the concern you would have in thinking of the findings, thinking of what you've learned so far as you've done the studies and as you've done the monitoring period with particular, what is the public health issue? What are the concerns you would have?
That's a great question. What we know about these metals is that worldwide through studies is that arsenic, cadmium, uranium, manganese, they are all associated with chronic health outcomes. So we've associated arsenic and uranium with both and cadmium with kidney disease here in the valley, but then also globally. Arsenic is a well-known cardiovascular and diabetes risk factor. And the levels that we're seeing in certain wells in the valley do increase the risk for those outcomes. We also have been completing a study evaluating the carcinogenic effects. The hard part is it's a small community, so we don't. It's hard to do cancer research in smaller communities. But when we look over a long period of time, what we've seen is that cadmium can be associated with breast cancer and some of the colon cancers that we're seeing. So overall, the goal is now that we've identified where the metals are and the potential health effects that we're seeing, our goal now is extending into what do we do to mitigate that exposure? How do we work with inclusively across the entire community so that we're reducing metals exposure, not only just in water, but we also have research now extending into the air and also the soil.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about is how do you mitigate it then if you're a family? And I think one that I'm familiar with is the Mestiz family in the southern end of the valley.
Yep.
And
I know them well.
Yeah.
Wonderful family.
And I wonder, what is their response to this, or how do you as a family deal with this type of situation within your own water well?
Sure.
That's what I wonder about.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great question. And our goal is not to do this research, identify a problem, and then disperse. We're actively working both with Colorado State University engineers that are focusing on the mitigating the air exposures, and then we're currently working with Arizona State University engineers, and they're focusing on the water, and they've actually have been using for the past 6 years now, using water that citizens in the valley have contributed to their lab, and they have developed this low-cost sustainable filter that we're our next study starting in 2 months is going to be implementing, because it's not NSF certified, meaning like they have to test the safety of it, we are going to be testing it on livestock wells that we've identified that have elevated levels of arsenic and uranium. And we're also, on the human side of things, we're going to be testing certain filtration systems and whether or not they are appropriate for the valley, because the goal is not just cleaning the water, but also conserving water. All right. So some filter systems use a lot of water to generate just a little bit of drinking water. So our goal is, how do we find a system that is low cost, low maintenance, affordable for everyone, but also doesn't waste water and also provides water with reduced metals.
Kathy, tell us who works with you on these studies. I know you have to have local resources on the
Absolutely.
Ground to make this work happen.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I appreciate you asking that, because without community partners and organizations and local boots on the ground, these studies don't happen. And so the San Luis Valley Ecosystem, led by Chris Canale, the Rio Grande Water Conservation District has been a fantastic partner, the Mineral County Public Health Nurse Joni Adelman, working in support of their CSU Ag Research Center, has been a fantastic partner. We've had multiple drop-off sites where people bring their samples, including all the way up in Villa Grove, Antonito, and then we also have the San Luis Public Health, so Costilla County Public Health. And then boots on the ground, you know, I've had Shirley Romero Otero, Ana Lee Vargas.
Sounds like you have all the right people.
Yes, I've been so fortunate. In our current studies, we have a community advisory board comprised of people from multiple sectors and roles within the communities and from across the entire valley. Augusto Bester Echea has been a fantastic support. And then we also have a new CAB that we formed in support of agricultural workers, and Carol Grulet is helping with that. So I can't express enough how much I have grown to genuinely enjoy not just the collegial partnerships, but the friendships that we've been developing over the years. And you mentioned the Mestos, Angie Mestos yeah. is partnering yeah. with us. So I just love how connected and close, and probably the most important thing is everyone comes from a different background here in the Valley, and I love hearing their stories, but they all share one thing. And this is when people ask me about working in a rural community, I always say, every single person is genuinely committed to the land, the air, the water, the people, their culture, and their heritage. And that's probably what brings me back and makes me enjoy every moment.
Are there concerns with contamination or other issues within the soil, within the dirt, within the property itself of some of the families you take, or some of the properties, is there concern that it goes beyond the water?
Right. That's a very good question. Whenever we think of old houses, we always have to think about lead. All right. So, and lead is, it's very well known. It was formerly in paints. It's also was used in old piping infrastructures. So we always take that into account. Interestingly, in most of our findings, we didn't see a whole lot of lead contamination in the wells, which is wonderful, because lead is a well-known neurotoxicant, especially with children. We did identify a few wells, and we worked directly with those participants to ensure that no one was drinking them, especially children, from those wells. The other ones that we tend to think about as far as interfering with the filtration process or contributing to the metals contamination, but isn't necessarily from the naturally occurring metals in the water, are things like copper. That can also come from home infrastructure. We also want to think about competing metals. So like iron and manganese, they like to compete and overwhelm filtration systems and then remove that efficiency for removing the ones we really care about, like arsenic and uranium. So we work with those and the engineers to develop these systems so that they're a multi-step system, so that we're able to remove the metals, but then also, as you noted, the kind of barriers or the the ones that get in the way of truly treating the water.
You know, one of the things I always wonder about, and I wonder if you could apply your research, your learnings, your knowledge to helping us understand the changing environments, the changing climates that we're all facing, but particularly here in the San Luis Valley, yeah, where we know we are one of the warming regions, one of the fastest warming. I mean, we're here in February, right? And it's beautiful outside. What is that, the changing climates, changing environments, what is that doing to soils, water, et cetera, in terms of the quality, if at all? I just wonder about that all the time now.
Yeah, no, that is a fantastic question. That the study that I'm presenting in today will highlight these dynamics of how drought, not only does it impact recharge, the geochemistry, if as the aquifer declines, it changes the soil dynamic and metals exchange between water, oxygen, and the soils. And we also talk about geothermal activity and how that's impacted. And we also look at land subsidence and how that also impacts the potential. So drought has this multi-pronged impact on how metals are entering into the water systems. And while we aren't necessarily seeing a direct link between drought and increases in arsenic, so that one is usually the community focus, what we do find is that the drought is impacting these other direct factors. So it ends up being an indirect factor on say arsenic, but it is impacting those that are direct. For example, subsidence, geothermal activity. One of the findings that we are trying to still decipher is uranium. We are actually seeing an increase in uranium over time, and we're not really quite sure yet about the processes. I'm currently partnering with Columbia University, who are breaking down and the isotopes, the different isotopes of uranium, and that will tell us where did it come from. How long has it been in the water? Is it recently in the water or has it been absorbed to the soil? And why are we seeing this increase?
It feels like we're just kind of at the beginning of understanding the era and the period of time we're living through when we think of global warming, climate change, environments, et cetera. I wonder what other work Colorado School of Public Health is doing, you're doing in this regard when it comes to studies and just helping us learn and understand this period of era that we're in.
Right. And fantastic question. I mean, one of the key things is, you know, I've been working with the San Luis Valley population and community organizations for nearly 20 years. And I've partnered with several other researchers, including like Lisa Sakuto, who's known as the Asthma Lady. She's from National Jewish, and she's been partnering with me. We're also partnering with CSU Engineering that is doing a lot of work down here now. And it's not just in the realm of water quality. We are looking at this total health of the community as a result of the prolonged drought, everything from the influences on water quality and not just how that impacts health, but how that impacts the amount of water. So CSU geochemists are focusing on recharge, the hydrology, and how the aquifer is being recharged and developing these long-term sustainable research recharge strategies. We're also looking at, you know, as that vado zone increases and we have more aerosolized topsoil and the wind patterns that are, you know, we're all familiar with the prevailing wind patterns and the dust storms. So how do we mitigate that exposure? Because that dust does carry the metals, especially from areas that might have been contaminated from former mining sites. So we are working with CSU to increase that access to mitigation strategies for households because, you know, the San Luis Valley has some of the highest asthma rates, some of the highest kidney disease rates, and we want to have an impact on the community and support the community for improving health long-term, for sustainability, and for long-term health.
Really an interesting topic, public health in the era of changing climates and what it's doing to things, and that's Kathy James, she's a PhD researcher with Colorado School of Public Health. She's presenting later on today on her San Luis Valley water quality study, but she's just another example of the really interesting conversations and topics you get into at the Southern Rocky Mountain Ag Conference. We'll be here for the next couple of days. Thanks, Kathy.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Okay. Have a good day.
Thank you. Hey, we're going to sit here and talk to Ava Williams. She's the outreach coordinator for the SLV Local Foods Coalition. We're at the San Luis Valley. We're at the Southern Rocky Mountain Ag Conference. You're here talking about a Colorado Department of Agriculture tax credit. Tell us about the tax credit and how it works.
So this is a program, as mentioned, from the Colorado Department of Agriculture, specifically for small family farms, which are defined as farms that make less than $350,000 gross per year, and small food retail businesses, preferably those that are less than 10,000 square feet and carry at least three of the federally defined staple foods. This equipment tax credit is specifically for equipment that helps businesses run. So this includes many different types of equipment, storage, refrigeration for farmers, things like irrigation equipment, tractors, delivery vehicles, freezers, deli processing, meat processing. Lots of different kinds of equipment are covered by this. It's a 75% reimbursement. So it's something that you would apply for at the end of the year with your taxes.
Would restaurants be eligible?
Unfortunately, no. So this program is specifically designed to expand access to groceries or foods in low-income, low-access areas, which is pretty much all of the San Luis Valley. We can make a pretty good argument that most businesses here benefit from having access to locally owned grocery stores. Lots of communities in the San Luis Valley are lacking that right now. So this program can kind of help get those businesses up and running.
So you get a state tax credit from the Colorado Department of Agriculture. Is there an expiration on when this program or how long this program is in place for through the state?
Yeah, so this program is supposed to run until 2030. There's $10 million per tax year for this program. There is no limit on how much you can apply for. Certain equipment just is eligible, you know, has to do a lot with the eligibility requirements, which is something that our organization can help, is technical assistance for that application, making sure that, you know, businesses have the documentation that they need, they understand the questions being asked of them. So pretty much when it comes to making sure that equipment is eligible, we want those small food retailers and small food or small family farms to apply within the tax year that they buy the equipment.
Gotcha.
However, they have recently extended this into the next year. So pretty much you can file and apply for this equipment reimbursement and up until you filed your taxes for example, 2025. So if you purchased any equipment in 2025 as a small food business here, you can apply up until you file for your 2025 business taxes. Once those are filed, that equipment is no longer eligible, but it'll be the same in 2026 all the way up until 2030.
Is there any other step or process that someone has to go through to get the tax credit other than working through your own accountant?
So we would obviously want people to make sure that they're keeping good records of the equipment that they buy, if that's what you mean. So there are things, for example, for a small food retail business, they would have to provide their retail permit. They would have to provide a deed stating the square footage of their property just to make sure that it meets those eligibility requirements. And then for all equipment, there has to be proof of payment and proof of purchase. So proof of purchase is like an invoice or a receipt, something that documents what the equipment is, the date that it was purchased. Proof of payment is bank statements or checks, things that demonstrate that the equipment was actually paid for.
And where would someone go to get more information, or if they had questions about this and aren't sure about it, where would they go to get more info?
So they can go directly to the Colorado Department of Agriculture website, go to the CDA tax credit website, and that's actually where the application is linked, as well as a Q&A website. This is for the entire state. Obviously, we're just talking San Luis Valley because that's who we offer technical assistance to, but this is a statewide program, so lots of businesses across the state would be eligible for this. So that's a good reference point for really in-depth information. But for SLV Local Foods Coalition, you can go directly to our website, which is www.slvlocalfoods.org/CFA. To contact us for any technical assistance and any assistance that individuals might need with their application.
We've been talking to Ava Williams. She's with the San Luis Valley Local Foods Coalition. There's a tax credit through the Colorado Department of Agriculture that you may be eligible for. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ava.
Awesome.
Hi, this is Chris Lopez with the Valley Pod. We're at the Southern Rocky Mountain Ag Conference. It's day two, Wednesday, February 4th. I'm joined by Sarah Jones. She's with Jones Organic Farms. We're going to talk to her about her operations, but really we want to ask you about the Rye Resurgence Project. She's one of the forces behind the Rye Resurgence Project. Just give us that first, the Rye Resurgence Project.
Yeah, I could talk about rye all day.
Yeah,
thank
we could.
Thank you for having me. So in a quick nutshell, macro, the Rye Resurgence Project is getting the word out of rye, the nutritional benefits of rye, the versatility of rye, how it can be grown here, and all of the boxes that it checks. So quick details on that would be uses half the amount of water, if not one third the amount of water, as a lot of our other main cash crops grown here. It's half the amount of gluten, twice the amount of fiber, super nutritious. It can be used in literally anything that we're baking at home. So I have some freshly milled rye right here that I milled up at our house this morning. The first bullet point I tell people is that rye does not taste like caraway seeds. So those famous Reuben pastrami sandwiches we all love with marbled rye, the flavor that people think rye is actually the caraway seeds in that.
I'm glad you said that.
Thank you.
I'm really glad you said that.
And I thought that not that long ago, right? And then a lot of people will say, oh, well, I like caraway seed. You're like, great.
Yeah.
But I don't want it in my brownies. I don't want it in my pancakes, my waffles, my chocolate chip cookies, which you can use rye in. The best rye brownies I've ever had were 100% whole wheat rye brownies. But you don't want caraway seed flavor in that. And
right.
The good news is it doesn't. So we can be using rye. An amazing pizza restaurant in Denver, we talked with them. They started using 10% rye in their crust within a week of getting them some freshly milled flour. They now use it in all of their crust, 10%, which equals 50 pounds of rye flour a week, which equals 1 acre of rye planted in the valley.
The genesis of the Rye Resurgence Project,
yes,
and rye as a crop,
yes,
was Jones Organic Farms, you and your husband, your family,
yes,
really looking for ways to diversify your potato growing, how,
yes,
to diversify and create a rotation crop in that,
yep,
operation, right?
Yes, yeah.
That's how
yes,
you got going.
Yep. So my father-in-law had been planting it since the 80s. It's one of the only things that can be planted after potatoes in the fall. And it's a nice warm blanket over our soil, a living root, carbon sequestration, all of the beautiful things for our soil. And then in the spring, when we get the crazy dust storms, it also helps hold down the soil and the dirt and the dust, and can literally prevent the Dust Bowl. So my father-in-law had been doing it since the 80s. When my husband and I moved down to the farm in 2017, we started getting into grain world and diversification. And then through wheat world, we started getting asked for rye. The amazing thing was that my father-in-law was already planting it. He was combining it, incorporating it, not selling it. And so when we got into wheat world, we started getting connected directly with distillers, bakers, millers, brewers, and then started getting asked for rye. And what an amazing blessing and opportunity to have a crop that's a cover crop and then also becomes a cash crop.
We've been to the Cody Farm where Colorado Farm Brewery is, and
yes,
we've talked to the Codys,
yeah,
about their use of it,
yes,
in their brews,
yeah,
as other things.
Yes.
Let me ask you, since you've been really focused on the, quote, Rye Resurgence Project,
yes,
what has been the momentum you've seen,
yeah,
in the crop and in its usage? I mean, you talked about pizza in Denver. You're talking,
yes,
about other ways it's being used. Give us just some,
yeah,
of the momentum.
Yeah, yeah, great question. I think, you know, for me, the takeaway has been the power of the small yeses, right? So that my father-in-law saying, yes, I'm going to plant this. It's the right thing to do. Joy Hill Pizza saying, yes, we're going to try this out. Yes, this is amazing. We're going to start using 50 pounds a week. So Cookies, Jess at Tumbleweed Bread is one of our, you know, big customers local. She's putting it in so many of her baked goods. And
we love Tumbleweed Bread, by the way.
Love Tumbleweed Bread. Her shortbread rye cookies. I mean, I win people over by just letting them have a nibble of that. A lot of, you know, whiskey companies now, you know, are using 100% rye.
So you're starting to see the market expand, which is really the goal, right? To expand and put rye in new markets, if you will, not just locally as we know about it, but take it into markets that may be not as familiar with the crop and how to use the crop. How's that going?
Yeah, it's going good. And it's, you know, for me, what can be challenging is it's a slow game, right? Which is sustainable. That's great. You don't want it to be overnight, you know, one customer. You want it to be sustainable, and it starts small. So Moxie Bakery in Boulder, they were one of our first customers. They're now buying probably quadruple the amount of volume. Is that because they're on board and they're using it in more things, or is it because more people in Boulder and Denver now are going to them and buying flour and baking with it at home and buying their baked goods because they've been hearing about the project and are really believing in what we're trying to do to, you know, prevent the Dust Bowl down here and help save our aquifer? I think the answer is yes. You know, we're starting small and we're building it, and that is true relationship sustainability.
What about locally in terms of San Luis Valley farmers? We asked this of the Codys in terms of, can other farm operations in the valley get into this as a rotational crop?
Yes.
Are you seeing any of that? And is there a danger, I guess, of saturating the market?
Yeah, great question. So just through, you know, pun intended, planting the seed of rye and reminding farmers that rye, you know, is a great crop here and can survive our winters, that has reminded farmers to plant it. So we have been seeing, I mean, thousands of acres planted. The beauty is that they're not just planting it and harvesting it and calling me and Heather up saying, okay, now sell it. They are grazing it, they're incorporating it, they're leaving it, you know, as is to cover the soil. They are harvesting it to save back seed, to replant, they're baling it to feed their animals. So it really has sparked this sort of reminder of a crop, I think, that was forgotten about.
Interesting.
And then we are slowly also building a market. So, you know, we're close to 1 million pounds sold, which isn't a lot in big commodity world. But, you know, the whole point was me as a small family farm, you know, our farm, we were only working with two distillers in the entire state. There's over 120 distilleries. So my hope was, like, if we could just copy and paste this sales and marketing and telling, you know, Colorado of what we're trying to achieve here, the possibilities are endless. We're doing a fun rye takeover in Salida. So March 7th, the grain chain is having their grain summit, March 7th. And the Rye Resurgence Project is teaming up with as many pizza restaurants, bakeries, distilleries, and breweries in Salida. And we're going to feature all of the businesses in Salida selling San Luis Valley rye. And we'll have a cool little map for everyone attending the conference to go and support those businesses using San Luis Valley rye.
That's amazing. I want to go back to the beginning and why you wanted to see a rotational crop, a diversification in your fields itself.
Yeah.
And a lot of that points back to water.
Yes. Yeah.
Correct that for me if I'm wrong. Tell me about that decision and why you saw it that way.
Yeah, so it was a twofer. You know, potatoes, alfalfa, and barley are three main cash crops here in the valley. And I like to say we're not just planting those like for fun. We're planting them because as Americans, we like cheap burgers, cheap beer, and cheap French fries and chips. So we are planting what the consumers, everyone, is eating and wants. And so, but those are really hard on our soil and really hard on our aquifer. They use a ton of water, right? And potatoes, you can't have a no-till potato because when you're harvesting a potato, you're tilling the soil. And then if you're leaving your soil bare for 6 months until you're planting back into it, when the wind blows, we're creating dust storm-like events.
Right.
So, yeah, we really believe in diversification of crops for resiliency, biodiversity, using less water, and always constantly trying to think of other things that use less water, like our little baby potatoes and rye.
One of the other things that's really important to note, I think, about Jones Organic Farms, the Rye Resurgence Project, the work your husband, you, your family are doing is where you're located. You're located in the Hooper-Mosca corridor of the San Luis Valley. You farm in Subdistrict 1, which is really the subdistrict that's being challenged to reduce its groundwater pumping, its footprint of water uses. So you're really in the middle of the storm.
We are, literally.
And you're finding a crop or finding a way to keep moving forward on the sustainability front of your operation.
Yes, we've cut our water usage by 50%, and we're able to do that by working direct with the customers. So, you know, cutting out middlemen so we can get more value out of our crops, growing a lot of new crops, peas, oats, millet, buckwheat, 20 varieties of potatoes, diversifying our customer base, trying to get the highest price possible for a beautiful, nutritious, you know, crop. So adding more value, telling the story.
I just think that's really important to note where you're located and not just your operation, but all those farmers, all those producers in that district are working so hard to stay relevant, to save on the water, but continue their operations.
Yes. So I found with the start of the rye project, you know, so obviously the start was my father-in-law planting rye in the 80s. One day, though, we had a crazy brownout dust storm. I got a call, you know, Amber alert, like alert on my phone saying, you know, you're not safe to drive, as we've all seen. And then a text from my kid's school that I couldn't pick them up.
Oh, wow.
So for me, that was a big turning point, right? Like, what are we doing? What is happening? And I, you know, kind of only allow myself to wallow, right, be mad for a few minutes, and then we got to think of some solutions to fix this.
Interesting.
So I started calling our neighbors, and they answered, right? Huge step. Calling someone, talking to them directly, getting an answer and connecting. And very curiously was just asking them, have you planted rye? If you haven't, why? I don't know, right? Tell me more. And then the answer again and again was no, because they didn't have a customer for it. They didn't have a home for it. That makes sense.
Right,
why
plant
something if you're going to throw it away?
Right.
And then two, they weren't getting paid enough. So maybe if they had grown it, they weren't getting paid enough. So the next question was, well, how much do you want? Five, 10 cents more. So for me, that was a really big turning point of if we can help sell the farmer's product, if we can find a home, right? Show me the money, as Jerry Maguire would say. Show me the purchase order. They are ready and willing. They will plant all of the things that the aquifer and soil need them to plant, but we have to be demanding it. We need a purchase order for them.
Really smart, progressive operation that you have going with Jones Organic Farms. I'm going to ask you one more thing. We'll let you go. Appreciate your time. You're going to preview a documentary here at the Southern Rocky Mountain Ag Conference. You're going to preview that this afternoon. Tell us how the documentary came to be and what the full release of that documentary.
Yeah, great question. Lindsay Hagen, I would say famous cinematographer. She's won awards. And she heard about our project. She reached out. I told her what we're doing here, you know, what, why and what. And she was sold. And came down, met with us, started filming. And so for her, though, really with documentaries, you know, you need funding. You need money to make a documentary. So she was looking for funding. She got fully funded very quickly by pitching the story and the documentary and what we're doing in the valley, the beauty of the valley, how special it is, our issues with our aquifer, what we're trying to do in this project, you know, trying to save our soil and save our aquifer and save family farms. And it's really a community effort, right? That common ground, which is so hard to find nowadays with how divided we are in, you know, everything, right? Everything's a dividing topic. It's not just politics and religion.
Right.
So she, we're featuring the trailer, also known as a sizzle nowadays, at 120. We'll be featuring a 5-minute sizzle of the work. And then she, over the next year, is going to be doing additional filming and creating the documentary. I just asked her, and it's hopefully going to be released spring of 2027.
That's a very cool, the Rye Resurgence Project documentary, something to look forward to. And what's really cool about what you said on that is it also takes the theme of saving the family farm. Jones Organic Farms is at the front of that. You're working on that. Sarah Jones, she's with the Rye Resurgence Project. Thanks for your time.
Thanks. Now go eat rye. And that's such a small ask, right? We're not asking for much, literally. Right. Like, go eat pizza, cookies, drink a little whiskey in moderation, don't drive, have a little rye beer. And it's that easy to help save our aquifer and our soil in the San Luis Valley.
Really
How fun is that?
Really cool project that's bringing awareness into the valley and into the work you're doing. And Heather Dutton and everyone else, really cool project. Yes. Thanks for seeing us.